Welcome to the Whole Enchilada, a community of high achievers that fight the status quo, rebel against mediocrity, and make life happen. Let's go.
Hey, Enchilada Nation, really excited to have you back with us today. I'm really excited about this conversation. I met our guest today, Pete Economos, a few years ago. I think you and I ended up on a mastermind somewhere together.
Yeah.
With a handful of other leaders within the KW world. And you know, when you're in a meeting with people and you start hearing someone else talk and share ideas, you're like, man, I'm really in alignment with the way that person's thinking. And you and I have kind of connected several times since then to bat ideas off each other.
Yeah.
Really excited about having you on the conversation today. So Pete is located in what part of Chicago are you out of?
We're in our western suburbs. So I actually live in Wheaton, Illinois, but our businesses are located pretty much all the western suburbs of Chicago.
Okay, awesome. And Pete's very similar position to me. He owns and operates several Keller Williams offices, several other companies as well. And I think more than the ownership piece of it, you're just a phenomenal leader. You have a lot of people in your world that you not only have been a great leader to, but you've grown up a lot of leaders and partners within your organization, which is really impressive. What else should our listenership know about you before we jump into our conversation?
That's a good question. I guess first and foremost, I've been married since 1999 to my wife. She's my priority in my life. I've got four kids. Love to ski. Love to compete with sports, any type of sport. And that's about it, kind of.
Okay. Kind of sport, huh? So like Indian leg wrestling, fall into that
category? Yeah, you name it, man. Right now I'm actually going through, we play a lot of pickleball.
Oh, yeah.
So that seems to be a big trend and whatnot. But anything we can do, I just like to be active and ski would be a passion of mine. So getting ready to head to Telluride next week, as a matter of fact. So
awesome. Yeah. It's funny growing up in a house with five brothers and one sister, it everything turned into a competition, right?
That's exactly.
It was like,
right.
We all played sports, even down to like who could eat the fastest at the table, who could do like everything.
Well,
was a
my brothers, you're probably battling for scraps, man.
Yeah. Especially as the middle kid, right? Like I was like, if I don't get moving, I'm not eating. So
yeah. I was the youngest. So I just, I had to compete, you know, in order to hang out. If I couldn't compete with my older siblings, then I wasn't allowed to hang out with them. So
interesting.
That's just the way it is. So
let's start our conversation there from being the youngest and you felt like you had to compete to be noticed and make that world. Do you think that's played into your success in life later in life, or is that just by circumstance?
No, I think that is a huge part of it and something that, we've tried to instill in our kids, not to be uber competitive and win at all costs, but understanding the value that sport brings into your life down the road. I've got four kids, three boys and a girl. My oldest played sports through high school, was done there, and has moved on to college. My daughter is a competitive soccer player, going to be moving on to D1 soccer. And then the boys, I've got two twins. They're only in eighth grade, and you can start to see that their fire's starting to burn to get into that high school
and do that.
And I just believe my, you know, I wasn't super academic in my background. My wife is a genius. I was just the kid that just loved to compete in whatever I did. And I think that has absolutely carried through to my professional career where it's, you know, I love to win.
Yeah.
You know? And that's actually a question I always ask in an interview. Do you love to win or hate to lose? For me, I just love to win.
Yeah. Well, you said something there that I think it sparked a thought for me, because you, within a couple sentences, you said there's two things you love. You love to compete.
Right.
And you love to win. And I think is like, that just kind of triggered a thought for me is I think if I walked here, I'm at a KW office, one of my KW offices down in St. George, Utah right now. If I walked down the hall and asked every agent here, do you love to win? Every single one of them would say, I love to win. But then the question is, do your activities reflect that you love to compete?
That's right. Right. Are you willing to do the work? So yeah. I kind of grew up my journey through athletics. You know, I played soccer growing up, baseball, basketball. I went into a high school process where, I played football. I transitioned over to football. I was lucky enough to be on a team that played in three state championship games. My senior year was the captain of a team that won that state championship. And I'm not bragging on that, but what that allowed me to do is experience winning at a very high level when you're ranked top five in the country or something like that, with no D1 athletes on your squad. We found a way to pull the guys together to compete at a very high level, even though they weren't extraordinary athletes playing at the next level, right? And I love that teamwork part of it. To me, that's kind of the strategy I employ, I think, in business is how do we get the most of what we got, right? Because everyone's got weaknesses, everyone's got strengths. And I love to be the guy that really focuses in on, okay, Marcus, you know, I know you, I know who you are as a person, and let's focus on your strengths rather than your weaknesses. And then let's build around that. That I kind of learned that going through high school. So, yeah. And was fortunate enough to have that experience for sure.
Yeah. I think I'm glad you bring that up. Cause going back to like the idea of growing up with five brothers, we played a lot of sports. We had a room dedicated at our house that held all the trophies, right? Trophy. And I had some brothers that were incredible athletes, and all their trophies were first place state champions. And every trophy you found for me through the house, for some reason or other, was second place here, third place here, runner up here, right? And so I didn't have that experience of that big win where I was like, this is what that feels like.
Yeah.
I almost, it fueled me in a different way of always being the guy that ended up in second or third, where I was like, my work ethic is, I'm going to catch up. I'm going to experience that, which has fueled me in a different way later in my career. But it's just
interesting. Yeah. And listening to what you're saying, you know, I come from a background, my mom was a stud. And she's what now 86. So she grew up in Biloxi, Mississippi, where she couldn't play sports. She couldn't go to college. She couldn't do a lot of this stuff. And my dad, uber successful, never played a sport in his life. So when I grew up and went through high school, my experience, I never, ever came home to a parent asking me, hey, did you do this? Did you do that? Did you do that? Right. The first conversation, deep conversation I had with my dad about sports was after my senior year. We won the state championship my senior year and got home probably about 9 a.m. and from celebrating. And my dad was reading the paper and drinking his coffee. And I walked in and I just went and sat next to him. And that's the first time he put down his paper, put down his coffee. And we talked for like 2 hours, and it wasn't like, what'd you think of this or what'd you think of that, but really just the whole process from freshman year through senior year and the work it took and just looking back. And that was one of the more, I didn't realize it at the time, but as I look back now and I look at my leadership journey, that was a really important moment to me as I try to lead others to become the leaders that I want them to be. I meet with them behind the scenes and we go through accountability and whatnot, but I really allow them to grab the reins and to go. And then I just kind of shape the conversations as we go, but I allow them to make their decisions and whatnot. And I think where I got that from, that patience, was through my dad. You know, kind of growing up. I grew up in a family. Grandfather came here at age 13 in 1913 by himself from Greece, didn't speak the language, didn't know a soul here. And by 1928 had four restaurants and two cars and was married. My dad never worked for anybody. Like, so that's just the kind of the way we're built, you know? So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
I love to hear those like true, like American immigrant stories that, you know, they came and changed their immediate family's life. But then if he could see the generations behind, what's happening.
Unbelievable. Awesome. Yeah. It's unbelievable. I mean, he was a shepherd. Their families were shepherds in Greece, sent them on a boat, didn't know a soul, was at Ellis Island for like 3 weeks before someone claimed them. And then 14 years later in the Great Depression had four restaurants. You know what I mean? Like
very cool story.
Yeah.
That's it's in your blood.
It's in my blood, man.
So let's talk about, you had mentioned a word that makes a lot of leaders cringe, and just a lot of people in general, including my teenage daughters. You said the word accountability.
Yeah. And
so let's talk about that, because I feel like that's such an important side of leadership, where I almost feel like leadership has these two buckets. One is a leader that's really charismatic, draws energy, can draw a crowd, and is exciting to be around and inspiring. And then there's this accountability of, can I hold you accountable to the results or the activities that draw the results? And it tends to be one person's really strong on the other and has to learn the skill set around the other side.
That's right.
I've seen people succeed on both sides of it, but talk to me a little bit about the importance of accountability to the people in your world and how that plays into your success.
Well, I think, you know, I'm very relationship based. So my approach with my leadership teams are very simple. I don't talk a lot. So it's very, you know, when people talks, they kind of listen, you know. But when we sit down, we go through, in the Keller Williams world, we have something called a 411, which is an accountability session that we go through on a weekly basis. And essentially we cover four parts, right? We cover their job, business, personal, financial, and personal goals. And we start with their yearly goals, work down to their monthly, and then we break it down weekly. And when I sit down with my leaders, it's on me to really, in my opinion, they won't let me in unless they trust me, right? And for me as a leader, if I can gain their trust and they let me in, I can push them farther than they've ever thought they could go. That's my opinion. And so we really, when we sit down on a weekly accountability session, first thing we start off with is the personal goals, right? So we talk about if they're willing, I don't ask, they're willing. Some people come right off the bat and share, some people wait a couple months or whatever, but I know how much weight they want to lose. I know, you know, what they want to accomplish this year on their personal side. When we go into personal financial, I know how much debt they have. I know what their savings goals are and whatever. So we talk for 15 to 20 minutes weekly just on who they are as people and where they want to go. And once we finish that, then we move on to the business side. And my belief on that is if they're happy at home, they're going to show up to work, right? And if they're showing up at home and doing things that they need to do, then I'm going to get the support of their spouse or their partner or their family to say, hey, let's keep going here, right? So that's just my belief on accountability. And what happens is generally speaking, I never have had a bad conversation with anybody, in my opinion. It's just bringing them through a series of questions to make sure they understand where they want to go. And if they're not hitting their goals, what's in their way and are they committed? You know, for me, it's always two questions. Is it a skills issue or is it a commitment issue? If it's a skills issue, I can coach you up. If it's a commitment issue, well, then that's a different conversation, right?
Yeah, I love that. And I when we had our pre-conversation and you had mentioned that too, it made me remember a training I went to several years ago where I heard a leader almost say it oppositely of like, you have to care about your people personally, but they have to earn the right for those conversations. So if they're in alignment with the business goals, then they earn the right to have the personal conversation. And I love that you have the foresight to flip that to say like, if I'm taking care of my people personally, and we're talking about the personal goals and I'm making that a priority, all of a sudden their commitment level to the business, particularly if they see that succeeding in the business is achieving the personal goals, yeah. Not only are you building that person up, but you're creating the loyalty there too.
That's right. And then over time, if they're not hitting their goals on the business side, so they're not hitting their financial goals, right? Then I go back to, well, this was your goal. And the reason why is because this over here on your personal side. Mm-hmm. So is that really important to you on the personal side? Because if it is, then let's change, you know, what we've got to change. Or maybe we just got to revisit your habits because you're not buying into the goals you're setting. You're just going through the exercise, right? And so I break that down over time to really get them to have an emotional attachment into that, right? So it's very rarely do any of my leaders ever have anybody in their lives that is, including their spouses, that are taking a look at how much money are you saving this week, right? How many times did you work out? what does that do for you? And I don't know, it seems weird, but it just works for me, I guess. It doesn't work for everybody.
No, I love that. So I got a couple follow-up questions in regards to accountability.
Yeah.
So one of them is a lot of our listeners are entrepreneurs that are succeeding at some level, getting to the next level. And one of the things that they want to learn or have tried to do unsuccessfully is leverage, right? And part of hiring someone isn't just giving things away. You're taking on leadership responsibility. And a lot of new leaders have this fear around having accountability conversations. Talk to me a little bit about like, how do you overcome that fear of having the accountability conversations? Cause they can feel uncomfortable until you learn the power of them.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Actually, one of my key hires in my life, not my first key hire, but one of the key ones was a gal named Karen Prawl who we got together in business with, and we met several times and talked about, okay, here's some metrics. If we hit that, this is what that can do or whatnot. And so we were all in alignment. And then I sent over to her our contract, our employment agreement, along with a 30-60-90, which outlines like, you know, what you need to do on a daily and weekly basis. And part of that was all my leadership teams text me their schedule every morning. And then we go through accountability once a week or whatnot. And Karen's never been held accountable before. And she called me up and just said, I'm not coming. I don't need accountability in my life. I thought was interesting. So I actually said, hey, why don't you call Jimmy, who used to work for me, no longer does. Hey, why don't you call Jimmy and ask him what that accountability looked like? So Karen called him up and Jimmy's like, hey, slow down, Karen. Like, this is a great, these are awesome conversations. They really, you know, they focus in on your work, but they also focus in on who you are as a person, and they round you out, right? And so Karen decided to come and agree to that accountability. And, you know, ultimately we made her a millionaire in about 3 years through awesome. That. What and cool, she drove cool through. It got to the point where she was so afraid about accountability when she came in 2018, she walked into my office in August, I'll never forget it, and slammed down a piece of paper on my desk. And it was our yearly goals. We call them the Keller Williams world, our 1-3-5.
Yep.
And she goes, I just hit every one. What's next? Right. So it changed her mindset around what accountability looks like. Never had a bad conversation with her. What was the goal? How'd you feel? Or how'd you do? How's that make you feel? Right. Like, we go through these series of questions with her and look at where she's at now. Right. She's big time KWRI regional director. She partners with me on our group she's exploded and I'd like to think maybe I played a small part in that for her, you know.
I bet she'd agree with that. I love hearing that story, because a lot of times we see these people that we know are incredible leaders and have this huge track record, and we think, well, they've always loved accountability, well, they've always done these things well, and that people don't realize it was a journey for them to get there as well.
Yeah, and you have to, no one's been held accountable at a high level for the most part, right? Yeah. And when you look at that, you've got to introduce that in a way that puts them at ease and then drives them, I think, further, you know, and by holding those accountability sessions over their goals, not mine, their goals, it takes the emotion out of the conversation. You know, when I was a real young kid, I want to say I was in college, I heard Jerry Reinsdorf is a professional sports owner of the Chicago Bulls and the Chicago White Sox. And a local radio station was interviewing him. And he just hired a new GM for the White Sox called Kenny Williams. And the guy was asking him, so are you going to tell Kenny to do this and who to sign or whatever? And he essentially sat back and said, hey, listen, if I tell my GM who to hire, who to fire, what to do, how do I hold them accountable? Because when we sit in those meetings and it backfires, Kenny's going to look at me and go, well, that was your idea. And that interview, I don't know why it sank in, but it sank in at the time. And that ultimately is kind of how I lead now, right? We talk about where we want to go as a group, but my leaders really have the say in where they want to go, how they want to get there. Even if I know I think they're going to mess up, I'm actually okay with that lesson being taught, because then on the accountability side, we can circle back and go, well, what happened? And none of my leadership teams can point back to me and go, well, that was your idea. Mm. Right. So I do shape the conversations over time. But at the end of the day, if I'm going to get buy-in from my leadership teams, they got to be all in on those goals. I don't know why that interview has always stuck with me.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I had an aha moment several years ago when I was interviewing one of my leaders, and he was kind of putting things back on me of like, I need you more involved in this. I need you to do this. And I kind of paused for a minute, and I asked this question. I'm like, in your opinion, what's the difference between a manager and a leader? Because really what he was asking me to do was to be the leader so he could manage.
Right.
And what I wanted him to do was be a leader. And the leader is the one that can say, just give me the vision and the parameters, and I will take us there.
Amen.
Manager says, give me the tasks and I'll make sure people do what they're supposed to be doing.
That's right.
Right.
Without question.
And it was me verbalizing to him, but I remember really it was an aha moment for me saying, okay, as a leader myself, am I creating a world of managers that need me to be the leader, or am I creating being a leader of leaders? Am I creating leaders behind me? And I just remember that moment clearly of like, okay, this is the time for me to step my leadership up.
To piggyback on that, right? So then your job as a leader to lead the leaders is, how can they lead according to your standards and your values? Right? Because if they hold your standards and your values, then I believe, or my values and my standards, then I can remove myself from the situation, because my agents understand that my leadership team upholds the same standards and values of which I do. And so they don't question that, right? It's where we get askew on that, or we go off on a tangent. That's when all of a sudden I get the phone calls and the emails and right? You see that kind of show up. So it's a journey for all of us.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. I want to go back to the accountability conversation for a minute. So when you hire someone new and you introduce this idea of accountability, how often do they actually come around and lean into it, versus how many times do they learn, like fight it and ultimately work themselves out of a role for you?
Around accountability. I haven't had anybody work themselves out of the role of accountability. I've had people who have seen the accountability that will be employed and have decided either it's not for them, or they've jumped in and they're uncomfortable. So maybe, I guess it does. Or they've jumped in and said, you know what, I just prefer to be my own boss or you know, do my own thing. And that's fine. I'd rather know that right off the bat. So yeah. So when we go through our career visioning, which is our interview process, it is clearly laid out exactly how that looks. So understand, I've got a gal that's coming in to lead one of my office who is a huge, massive producer, right? Hundreds of units. And she wants to jump in our world on the leadership side. We went through the accountability with her, and she is all good, looking forward to it. That's the type of people you want, right? Show me the way, show me what I need to do, get out of the way, and check in once a week.
And it says a lot about, in my opinion, it says a lot about your leadership and track record, that there's leaders like that saying, hey, I want in.
Yeah.
I want to play.
Well, I think that takes time, right? When we look at our staffs and our teams, you got to walk the walk, I think, as a leader. So I started on my true like owner, you know, OP role or operating partner role in what I do in 2010. And I brought on Jack Ehlert, who was my first team leader, and we worked together and had very good communication. He is actually my mentor in many ways. And we got to a point where we kind of passed him by. And I said, hey, Jack, you know, we sat down, we got a great great relationship to this day. And I said, hey, I think we passed you by as an organization, right? You know, he was in his middle 70s, you know, and you get to a certain point where he was tired. He had been doing it for some years. And so I said, why don't we do this? Why don't we go start a new business over here? And let's you and I do that as partners. And then I'll find someone to run this. And he was all in, right? And so we went and started that business together and are still 50-50 partners in that today. And then I brought the new person in. Every one of my accountants or our MCAs in our world started at our front desk, worked their way through the system all the way up. There's evidence everywhere in our organization that we take care of our people. And if we have a conversation about an opportunity or something like that, that they know that they can trust that what I'm telling them will come to fruition, right? Because if they question it, I go, well, why don't you go call Jack? And then when you're done with Jack, why don't you go call Karen? And then when you're done with Karen, why don't you go call the other Karen? And then go call Jack Kelly. And then go, right? And so now we have evidence of all these people. All my people, for the most part, have been with me since they've started, right? And I think that's because they know I care. Listen, you know, when Julie came to me in 2010, she couldn't put food on her table. And 3 years ago, she came up to me and said, hey, I just bought a house, right? And she's our market center administrator, a single mom. And that means the world. That means more than anything else that we've done in my world. And my people know that.
Yeah.
That's right. So they know I'm in. They know I'm in, all in.
So we've talked a lot about the opportunity and responsibility of a leader and getting permission to have the accountability conversation with those that you lead. Talk to me a little bit about self-leadership, because I'm self-accountability, because I'm curious to see if there's a correlation between how well someone can hold themselves self-accountable to earning the right to hold somebody else accountable.
Well, you know, it's a good question. My journey is this, man. So I graduated from Purdue and I went into work for a company called Houston's Restaurants. And I was working 80 hours a week, making 26 grand. And I was like, this is for the birds, right? Like, I don't mind working 80 hours a week, but not for 26 grand.
Right.
And so I hopped into real estate and I became pretty successful in real estate. My dad, though, had done it for 45 years. And I knew I didn't want to do it for 45 years. And I'm just going to briefly touch on this story and then I'll get into, I guess, how I do it. But so in the early 2000s, my wife and I started buying real estate properties. And then maybe it's the way I carry myself. I don't know, man. But then all of a sudden I had a guy come to me and go, hey, I got like $150,000. What should we do with it? And then literally like a month later, someone came up to me and said, hey, I got like 200 grand. What do you want to do with it? And so I started to realize people trusted me, right, with their money. And we went and started syndicating properties and buying big properties and doing whatnot and did really well. 2008 hit after the crash. And my wife and I bought a big building that we were going to convert. And one day woke up and our bank went under and we had personal guarantees on everything. And in 2010, we went from a seven-figure balance sheet to negative whatever. And I came home every day to Kate crying at the kitchen table and us eating pasta for a really long time. And at that point, the owner of our office in Naperville said, hey, Pete, why don't you buy our office? I'm losing a couple $100,000 a year. This isn't working. And I said, well, Bill, you know what I just went through. He knew everything about me. And he said, well, just make me an offer. You know, and I said, so we were sitting at a bar. He drew it on a napkin. And I'm like, hey, before we sign off on this, I got to go talk to my wife. And so I came home and Kate said, well, you just go build us a company. I'll go back to work. And we had four kids under six, right? So since that time, since 2010, my self-accountability is never to put my family nor my wife remotely close to that position ever again. It took us 7 years to dig out of that hole. It was a big hole. And so my motivating factor is the girl I go work out with every day at 5 a.m. Like, I'm giving her the best life possible. And that's the core of who I am. And so when I talk about when I wake up in the morning and I go to bed at night, I think about what can we build that will create a better life for us. And then once we're spoken for, we live a very simple life. Once we're spoken for and I can get, and I'm almost there to that point where I'm self-sustaining, then everything I do will be to help others that need it. And that's my goal. So I don't need the Lambo or the 6,000 square foot house. I don't know. I have to wake up every day feeling good.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing that story because I think it's interesting. A lot of these young hustling entrepreneurs I know that are really incredibly talented, you know, their careers started after 2010, 2011, 2012, and they know an upward swing. That's all they know, right? Yeah. And so it's interesting to watch their motivation because their motivation is what they see as defined as wealth on social media of like, I want those things.
Duh.
And so they're either motivated towards those things or they say they want those things, but comfort keeps them from actually getting to the next level. Where I think there's not, unless that you lived through the last downturn, you don't have that real clarity of what the negative side of business could feel like. That is also a huge motivator to say, I'm not going to put my family in that situation again. I am not going to take a risk that I have to lay awake at night and think, how am I going to get out of this?
Yeah. That's my everyday. I paid every debt I had. We tried to float lumber for a long time. Like we fought and I didn't do anything wrong. My bank, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it is interesting. So at our local high school here, we have an entrepreneurial class. And so I go in every year and my role, or at least what I teach in it, is Tam and Sam. As far as these kids create a company, then they have to go through the market research and do all this stuff. And some of them have launched actually very successful companies straight out of high school. But I always tell the story of being an entrepreneur. And I've had one of my kids in that class and I asked Nick, hey, listen, do you mind if I tell the story of 2010 to your peers? And he's like, no, absolutely. And I tell him that, like, hey, listen, man, when you come home every day for 6 months and your wife's crying at the table and you're eating pasta and you don't have enough money to do anything, right? That's going to happen to you as an entrepreneur, but you can't judge yourself by that. You judge by yourself by what do you do about it, right? I could have easily rolled over, declared BK or do whatever I wanted to do. That was the easy route out and just say, hey, life screwed me, right? But that's just not how I'm built. And I think I have a lot of pride and probably when I look back and what I'm most grateful for and what I'm most proud of is, and Kate and I were talking, like we went on our 10-year anniversary, we went to Herrick Lake Forest Preserve and had a peanut butter and jelly because we couldn't afford to go get McDonald's. Right? Like that's real.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what I'm most proud about is A, when you do that with four kids under six and you've got a wife and she says, hey, go build a company, I'll go back to work. The level of confidence she had into me as a person and as a husband was something that I'll never forget that moment. That's the best part of my marriage ever, was that moment.
What
and that's
cool
kind
story.
Of shaped me. Yeah. So I tell that story to the kids because I want them to understand being an entrepreneur, being a leader, you're going to fall flat on your face and you got to get up, like get over it.
Yeah. No successful entrepreneur I know doesn't have some element of a story of failure, right? Some are greater than others.
Yeah,
but it's all the people, the wannabe entrepreneurs, that the first stumble, the first obstacle is like, nope, I'm out of here.
It's the ones that are, in my opinion, and I just laugh, but it's the ones that are like, the minute they do something right, it's all over social media.
Yeah,
those are the ones I always sit back and go, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll right? see. We'll see.
We'll see. Those are my two. I say those words a lot. We'll see.
So the one kind of to start wrapping up our conversation, I do. Yeah. I do really quickly want you to share. I was really impressed with you kind of casting that vision of your long passion goal. Like, right, you are on this path of building these incredible companies. You're on this path of building these great leaders that you're creating big opportunities for behind you. You've created your financial goals. But I really love that you have this passion of what you want to build. Well, share with our listeners a little bit about that.
Cool. So when I started on my leadership journey in 2010, I bought an office that had 6 agents in production, $37 million in sales, right? And so now we're pushing that 1,300 agent mark, around $3 billion in sales. And I've got leaders underneath me who are great people. And I watched my dad do this for 45 years, which is why I got out of selling essentially. And now I'm doing what I'm doing, but I'm ready. I'm at the point where I believe the companies need a new voice that's fresh and has that energy to drive it forward. So I think I'm smart enough to know that I think it's time for a change. And I think I've recruited and brought into the organization the right people. So by the time I hit 50, which will be 2025, I'll be able to hand off the organization to them. And I'll do that and they'll become owners with me. So I'll divest a little bit. And I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to help them with their businesses and the businesses and create new ones. But ultimately, I will be spoken for enough to where I'll probably move out to Southwest Colorado, somewhere out there. But I want to go into a community and really just go into the high schools and City Hall and whoever I need to talk to figure out who are the families in the community, because we'll probably go to a smaller town, that have some special needs kids. And I want to use my expertise. I went to Purdue for restaurant management. I've operated restaurants before. I want to go in and partner with those families where their special needs kids come and work. So they live, they get an earning wage, right? And they're making do. And I want to go in and build a restaurant to the point where the first profit goes towards all of our expenses. And then after we meet all those expenses, every dollar that we earn in profit will go into those special needs family, like a trust or what have you, however we decide to set that up. So we can give those parents peace of mind when they've moved on from this world that their kids are spoken for. And I think that's their greatest fear. And it's a huge stress in their life. And I don't need the glamour and the you know, the publicity around it. I just want to go into a really cool and have this community just rally around these guys, right? And I think if we can find the right community to do that in with the right people, I know it's going to help those families and I know it's going to give them peace of mind. But I also think in those communities, it's going to give them a source of pride that they're taking care of those who need the help. And let's just rally around those people rather than ignore them. And, so that's my next passion. So I'm hopefully 3 years away from being able to go and start that process of doing that. Again, I wouldn't take a dollar out of it, just pay the bills. Everything else would go into those kids' funds so that they're spoken for when mom and dad have moved on. And that would be, you know, a lot of people want to do a lot of these grand things. I don't think it's that grand. I just know that I would have a passion around helping those families out. So that's ultimately what we're going to do, man.
Man, I love that. This gives me chills to think about it.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate some of the things you said. I was sitting here taking notes of some things that I'm going to go back and put some more thought time into to grow my own leadership and think through some things. I really appreciate your leadership and being able to share and being vulnerable today. I think not only connecting with me, I think it's going to connect with a lot of our people. So thank you.
Well, I hope so, man. And if any of you guys are ever in the Chicagoland area, you know, give me a call. Like, I love talking with people from wherever and hearing their stories and hopefully you grabbed a nugget or two out of this one.
Yeah, I mean, I took a handful of notes here, but the two couple things that I want to just touch on to wrap up our conversation, and I'll give it back to you to share any last thoughts you have. But you said a couple things that I think are really interesting. Number one is, I think every single person that's listening to this, you're being faced with some element of a challenge right now, whether it's market driven, it's personal driven, it's relationship driven. You have an obstacle or a challenge in front of you. And a couple minutes ago, Pete, something you said is, what are you going to do about it? That's one of the biggest differentiators of someone that's going to succeed versus someone that's going to wallow and kind of piddle out is we all have something. Some of those obstacles are bigger than others, but what is it you're going to do about it? I challenge you today to stop after this and think, what is that challenge and what specifically am I going to do about it? And hold yourself accountable to it. The next thing I challenge you to do is say, is my vision of where I want to go big enough and clear enough? And yes, for the majority of us, a lot of our visions and goals are built around our immediate needs and wants. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's enough in today's world to like grow something big enough. We have to think beyond that, down the road to that restaurant you want to build that's going to give back to the local community or whatever it is. It doesn't matter what it is, but if you haven't got enough clarity around what it is you want to create beyond yourself, then that's the next step beyond you succeeding. And you're not going to have enough fire in you to get to where you want to go if you don't create something beyond that. So those are the kind of two things that I really wrote and starred here for me to think, do some more thinking time about is, what is that next obstacle? What am I going to do about it? Who am I going to take with me? And am I thinking big enough, long vision about like what impact and legacy am I going to leave beyond that? Pete, leave us your kind of last couple thoughts. Any thoughts or comments you want to leave with the group?
I do put a lot of thought to my legacy and how I want to leave it. And ultimately, for me anyways, I want my legacy that I help people get to where they want to go. And at the end of the day, if I can do that, I'm really happy with what I've done in my work here, you know? And I also think, you know, to go back and piggyback on what you just said, that the defining moment for my family was after my biggest failure I ever had was my reaction to it. And I just encourage all of you guys, whether that be physically, spiritually, business, whatever that is, like, listen, it happens, right? Life happens. And so just put the boots on and get to work to where you want to go. You know, we always overestimate what we can do in a year, but we usually underestimate what we can do in five. So if you actually just set goals, hold yourself accountable to those goals and look back 5 years later, you're going to be way farther down the road than you ever thought you'd get. Contrarily, if you don't set those goals and don't hold yourself accountable to them, odds are in 5 years, you're going to be exactly where you're at today. And ultimately, yeah, the choice is yours. Where do you want to go? And life doesn't stop for anybody. Life's not fair. So get over it and just go get it done. Yeah. That's just my take, man.
I love it. I'm in alignment with you. Thank you again for sharing your thoughts with us today. Enchilada Nation, I hope you guys got something out of this conversation today. Don't forget to go follow us on social media, like and subscribe to the channel. And don't forget, go live life on your terms.